From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Caudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Last March, the Idaho legislature passed and Governor Brad Little signed a bill that sets a new bathroom policy for Idaho public schools. It requires students must use the bathroom or locker room that corresponds with the gender they were assigned to birth. Now, that law went into effect in July, but it was paused by a district judge just last month while a lawsuit works its way through the courts. Yesterday, Judge David Nye heard arguments from both sides about the current temporary restraining order, as well as a request for a preliminary injunction in this case. So what happens now? Well, we asked Boise State Public Radio reporter James Dawson, along with McKay Cunningham, the director of on-campus exponential learning at the College of Idaho, to join us today to break down the law and the lawsuit. I want to welcome both of you back to Idaho Matters.
Hey, Gemma.
Hi. Thanks.
So, Jimmy, let me start with you. Take us all the way back to February, because this was when the Idaho legislature had the bill brought up. So take us to that point.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point in session in mid-February where everything is kind of clicking. I mean, you're getting just tons of committee hearings on a whole number of issues, this being one of them. So it was introduced in the Senate in mid-February, where it kind of lingered for a couple weeks in committee and on the floor before lawmakers decided to add a little bit of an amendment to it. And like I said, this was happening amid several bills, specifically ones that targeted transgender people, including one that outlawed gender-affirming care for minors and another one related to state contracts.
So, Jimmy, what exactly does this particular bill say, and what did it require schools to do?
Yeah, I guess I'll use a cliche from the State House. It's kind of a fairly simple bill, but basically, if a student is born male or female, they are not allowed to use multi-occupancy bathrooms, locker rooms, or other changing facilities of the opposite sex. If you've got, you know, one of those family-style single-use bathrooms, that's totally fine. There are also a few exceptions for people like janitors, emergency medical folks, or coaches who oversee teams of the opposite gender. They can go in those rooms if necessary. Supporters say allowing transgender people to use bathrooms that align with their gender identity, and this is in the bill itself, quote, generates potential embarrassment, shame, and psychological injury to students, as well as increasing the likelihood of sexual assault, molestation, rape, voyeurism, and exhibitionism, end quote. That line about assaults and rape has been a repeated talking point here and in other states around the country, but really haven't been shown to actually happen. And that's including a sexual assault in Virginia a couple years ago where the perpetrator was wrongly labeled to be transgender. One of the other key provisions in this bill and law that's actually still on hold is that any student who claims they saw someone of the opposite sex in their bathroom or locker room could file a lawsuit against the school within 4 years for $5,000 for each occurrence that happens.
So, Jimmy, as I mentioned in the introduction, the bill did pass, but it was signed by the governor as well, correct?
Yep, passed overwhelmingly along party lines, and the governor signed it without much fanfare. Occasionally, he'll issue a statement about controversial bills he'll sign or veto, but chose not to for this one. And prior to taking effect, I should say that local school districts were the ones choosing whether or not to have a policy that allowed trans students to use bathrooms or changing facilities that aligned with their gender identity, and only about a quarter of them in Idaho did.
Okay, so Jimmy, let's move forward to July 1, because that's when the bill was set to take effect. So did it ever take effect?
It did, but schools were out for the summer. So, they really didn't have to worry about it too much. And, you know, that's why you had Judge David Nye issue that temporary restraining order before schools, students returned to school in August.
So who brought the lawsuit, Jimmy? And what does the lawsuit say and claim?
Yeah, so this is from an anonymous 12-year-old trans girl who is enrolled in the Boise School District. In court documents, she's referred to as Rebecca Rowe. Her parents were also on there. The Boise High School student group Sexuality and Gender Alliance is another one of the plaintiffs. And, you know, there are arguments that we've seen, you know, in other states, and they were raised by lawmakers as well, that this law violates the 14th Amendment, which is supposed to ensure equal protection under the law, essentially that trans students are being treated differently than cisgendered students in this situation. They also say it's a violation of the federal Title IX law that prevents discrimination on the basis of sex. Now, that's something that, you know, has been playing out in the federal system for a while, because the Biden administration has moved to include sexual orientation and gender identity within that definition of the basis of sex. And then finally, these folks claim that it's also a violation of a person's right to privacy to be forced to reveal their gender identity.
Okay, so then in August, Judge Nye, as you mentioned, Jimmy, granted this temporary restraining order that blocks the law from going into effect, which put a pause on the law, at least for now. McKay, let me bring you into the conversation now, because now we're caught up to what happened yesterday. Can you explain to us the difference between a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction?
Yeah, a temporary restraining order is often termed extraordinary relief or an extraordinary remedy, because courts should usually be fairly reticent to enter a temporary restraining order, and usually the plaintiff essentially runs to the courthouse and says, judge, you must enter this temporary restraining order and do it quickly, because imminent harm is about to occur. And if you don't issue this temporary restraining order, there's going to be imminent harm. Now, it's deemed extraordinary relief because a lot of times the court doesn't have the benefit of having a lot of argument, doesn't have the benefit of having a lot of evidence or time or briefing, but has to act immediately. And so it's a pretty big burden that the plaintiff has to show in order for the court to grant a temporary restraining order. They usually only last for about 14 days. And so in this instance, the court, as we just heard, Judge Nye granted the temporary restraining order on August 10th and immediately set a hearing to discuss the preliminary injunction. So the difference between the two really is that the temporary restraining order is exigent and you have to act very quickly. And then we have a little bit of time. Both parties can now put forward their best arguments before the preliminary injunction is to take place. And it's also a very heavy burden for the claimants to have to show. They have to show that they are likely to succeed on the merits. They have to show that they will suffer irreparable harm if the court does not grant this preliminary relief, and that the balance of equities tips in the plaintiff's favor, and that an injunction is in the public interest. So this is a pretty big burden that the plaintiffs in this case has to prove, and probably what they argued at length in yesterday's hearing.
So, McKay, can we go back also to the point that Jimmy made about privacy and this idea of violating the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which is a right to privacy? I mean, as a parent, I'm sitting here thinking, it's nobody's business for me to have to show any information about, you know, their assigned gender at birth. I mean, that if I want to, fine. But how in the world are we even having this discussion, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it was just mentioned a second ago that any student can file a lawsuit seeking $5,000 for each occurrence in which a person who is transgender is using the quote-unquote wrong bathroom. And if you are a school district and you're trying, you know, your budgets typically are not that big. You don't have a lot of discretionary funding. You need to avoid being sued over and over and over again for $5,000. All to say, how did they enforce this as a school? I mean, you've got to find out all of the students who are transgender within your school district, if you're a superintendent or principal or whomever. And isn't that a privacy violation? What about the privacy of these students as it relates to their sexuality? I will say, Gemma, that I think that the stronger arguments and the ones that the parties, or at least the plaintiffs, forwarded in their briefing is really along the lines of the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution and Title IX, as opposed to privacy-based arguments.
Okay. So that was really the basis of the arguments then yesterday. It wasn't necessarily privacy, because we've seen that, McKay, even with the fall of Roe v. Wade, right? Is that frankly, that was able to be overturned. Whereas if you look at equal protection under the law, what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is that could potentially be a much stronger argument.
Yes, that's exactly right. The Equal Protection Clause was not in the original Constitution. It was actually ratified in 1868 following the Civil War, part of the Civil War, so-called Civil War amendments. And it's kind of an open phrasing. It says, no state shall deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws. And what does that even mean? No state shall deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws. And for decades, it meant nothing. No one could really figure out what it meant. In fact, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously quipped that it's kind of a kitchen sink argument. Lawyers just throw it in there when they really don't have any other thing to argue. It's an argument of last resort. But over time, the Equal Protection Clause became a way to protect discrete and insular minorities from laws that purposefully discriminated against them, like people of color, and laws, for example, that only white people can serve on juries, and of course, gender as well. Discrete and insular minorities, laws that purposefully discriminate against women, were protected under the Equal Protection Clause. So there's all kinds of examples of that. There's one famous case where a state had a law that a woman could not be a bartender unless her husband or her father owned the bar. Or, of course, no woman can join the Virginia Military Academy. So there's a lot of case law under the Equal Protection that suggests if a state in a law singles out a detriment based on a class, a protected class, then the Equal Protection Clause, it requires courts to really highly scrutinize that law.
Okay, so Judge Nye heard arguments in court yesterday. McKay, what do we know at this point of what was argued, but then what happens now?
Yeah, the principal arguments were an equal protection argument based on the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and an argument based on Title IX. And we can get into the details of what those arguments look like, Gemma, if you'd like. But what happens now is we wait. The arguments, I think, are really fascinating. There's a circuit split here in the United States. That means that there are circuit courts, the 13 circuit courts here in the United States, as are federal appellate courts, and they are split. And there's a few circuit courts that have ruled that laws very similar to this one are unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. And there's at least one circuit that says, no, these laws are fine under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So I think our judge here is going to weigh all of the arguments made and look at some of that precedent from those other courts. And I think what we do now is we wait.
So, McKay, I know we touched on in the last segment about the 14th Amendment and equal protection. Can you talk a little bit about this other argument in regards to Title IX that was brought up?
Yeah, you bet. The Title IX argument is it's a federal statute, Title IX, and it very generally it bars gender discrimination in education contexts. And here the question is this a gender discriminatory law? And I think that's kind of a curious issue. Is transgender identity, is that the same thing as gender? Because historically, Title IX, at least traditionally and historically, has applied to females as they are differentiated from males. And is transgender, does that mean the same thing? In other words, the statute specifically disallows discrimination based on sex. That's the term, sex. Is gender identity, does that fall within sex? And fascinatingly, the Ninth Circuit has recently ruled, 2023, that discrimination against transgender people constitutes discrimination based on sex. And so this, I think, is particularly strong argument here because the Ninth Circuit, which is the circuit that has authority over the federal courts in in Idaho. So that means it's binding authority here.
Mm-hmm. So, McKay, just so I'm understanding this. So what, I know it's a wait and see at this point, but does everything remain status quo at this point with this injunction being in place right now as we wait?
Yes. If I'm a school superintendent, I've got my eye on every single thing that happens in this case, but the status quo remains in place, meaning that the statute, the bathroom statute, will not be effective so long as the court continues to consider the temporary injunction that is before it.
Okay. So, Jimmy, at this point, do we know then what public schools are doing right now? School has been in session for going on, a month, give or take, depending upon where you live in Idaho. So status quo right now, but are they preparing, as McKay said, for any possible changes?
I would imagine that, like McKay said, that any sort of superintendent or principal is closely watching this just to see what happens. But as far as I know, the school districts reverted back to whatever policies had previously been in place. So, like I mentioned, about a quarter of Idaho's schools, according to court documents, did have policies that allowed transgender students to use the bathroom that aligned with their gender identities.
So, Jimmy, with this, staying status quo right now, so this law is not in effect right now, have you heard from any lawmakers who were so strongly for this law to go into effect? Because as you mentioned in our last segment, I mean, this passed by a generous majority. This was not a close fight here.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the far right of the Idaho Republican Party and their lawmakers that have been elected to those positions certainly have said, this isn't great. We're going to prevail in courts. Judges shouldn't be, essentially acting against the will of the people is how they see it. So certainly they've made it very clear that they are not for this temporary restraining order and possible preliminary injunction.
So I find that interesting, though, when they bring up the lawmakers who are proponents of this law, saying the will of the people, because McKay, my understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the majority of Idahoans, when polled, would disagree with that statement.
Yeah, I actually don't know the answer to that, Gemma, and I can't speak to it. I mean, we can speak to questions with regard to women's reproductive health and having abortion rights. Typically, especially across the country, there's a clear majority of people who are in favor of some abortion rights, even though the law has gone the other way. I just don't know of a survey done in Idaho to this particular question.
Okay. So with that said, though, McKay, let's go back to these arguments as we talked about the Equal Protection and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and then Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. In your legal opinion, are these strong arguments? Or, I mean, and I ask that because, as you said, we are bound by the Ninth Circuit, which a lot of opponents would say is a highly liberal circuit. So of course they would rule the way that they have. We have dissent, across the country, as you said.
Yeah, I think this is a new battleground with regard to transgender persons. It's fascinating because, as we said a while ago, that the Equal Protection Clause requires courts to closely scrutinize any time a statute singles out an insular minority for detriment. And the question is, are transgender persons part of a protected class? And that is, in my opinion, the heart of the constitutional question in this case. Are transgender persons part of a protected class? And the court typically looks at three factors to answer that question. Has this group, the transgender persons, have they historically been discriminated against? One. Two, are they politically powerless such that they cannot protect themselves through ordinary democratic processes? And three, is the characteristic immutable? Is being a transgender person immutable? Meaning, is it unchanging or unable to be changed over time? Is being a transgender person a choice? Or is it something that is unchanging and unchangeable? So those are the factors that the court has historically looked at to determine whether or not a specific group should be elevated to a protected class. And as I mentioned earlier, the Ninth Circuit appears to have addressed that already in a case called Karnofsky versus Trump. The Ninth Circuit recognized that transgender people bear all of the indicia, of a quasi-suspect class, such as being subjected to a history of discrimination and lacking sufficient political power to protect themselves. So I think that because we are in the Ninth Circuit, as you mentioned, this case is particularly, the arguments are pretty strong here for the plaintiff.
McKay, I want to go back to something that you brought up briefly in the very first part of the program today. And that's this idea that a student can sue a school for at least $5,000. This is a part of that law that's on pause right now. Can we just take a little bit of a closer look at that? Because this is the civil aspect of it. And how does this part of that law really play into the argument, to the legal argument, to where we are in this right now?
Yeah, this is kind of a trend recently through state legislators. And that is to allow almost anyone to be a plaintiff for students, for example, in any of these schools. If this law goes into effect, they can be a plaintiff. They can bring a lawsuit for $5,000. Now, ordinarily, that type of approach it's just a kind of a rare approach, because enforcement of laws is typically relegated to law enforcement personnel rather than citizens. You saw that, by the way, recently in Texas's abortion law passed last year, Senate Bill 8. It empowers private citizens to sue anyone who aids or abets an abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. So these kinds of laws are becoming more favored, and particularly in red states. And one of the reasons, I think, is because it facilitates enforcement, but also it keeps these kinds of disputes in state court, because it typically a federal court will not allow plaintiff to go forward. A plaintiff's case will not go forward unless they can first demonstrate that they themselves have been injured. So someone who just happens to know that a transgender kid used the bathroom that was not assigned to that person at birth, what is the real injury there? This law says, well, you don't have to have an injury. You just have to know about it and report it. And that $5,000 is yours. And so these kinds of approaches that conscript, if you will, the general population to be enforcers, has been rare historically and is increasingly more frequent in current legislation.
So the law says the school is at fault if they give someone permission to go into the bathroom, or if, and I'm quoting here, fail to take reasonable steps to prohibit that person from using facilities of the opposite sex, unquote. So McKay, any idea I think when a law becomes ambiguous like that, reasonable steps, I mean, what in the world does that mean, or do we even know what that would involve?
Boy, I'm interested to hear what you and James think about that, because we don't know. And that is troubling for a lot of different reasons. If you are a risk adverse principal or superintendent, what are reasonable steps? Are you going to, again, try to find out each and every student who identifies as transgender, and is that in and of itself a violation of their privacy? And then at that point, what do you do? Do you post a policy online? Do you put notes on the bathroom doors? Do you have attendants that monitor who goes in and out of each bathroom? I mean, Boise High School has 1,600 students. So, what reasonable steps, what that means, is going to play out in the courts, which is, you know, another expense to have to figure out what the law is on an ad hoc case-by-case basis.
So, James, let me bring you into this then, this idea of reasonable steps. You cover the Idaho legislature every single year. This is not a new idea to, as I said, put ambiguous language into a bill, and then it leaves citizens scratching their heads asking, well, what does that mean? So when this bill was presented, and then when it became law, did lawmakers give any sort of idea of what they meant by reasonable steps?
Off the top of my head, I can't recall that necessarily came up. It certainly was a concern, I believe, during committee hearings and floor debates, though, that, you know, just what we've been talking about right now, what do reasonable steps look like? And like you said, I mean, this is a pretty standard thing to put into bills and laws that get passed, sometimes to give agencies or whatever, you know, entity is being affected by a bill to give them some flexibility. So you're not just saying you have to do X, Y, and Z. And if you don't, then, you know, we're going to come and take your money. But in these cases, like you and McKay said, it leaves a lot of things ambiguous, and we have no idea whether something is good enough to qualify under the law. So it's a crapshoot, and it's not as uncommon as people might think.
So McKay, how would something like that then play into this idea of if you have something on the books like this, in particular, this $5,000, bounty, almost, I guess, that you could bring against a school. What about this idea of targeting then a minority group like these transgender students, and how would that play into a potential legal argument? And let's say this law passes, and let's say something like this happens. I mean, and someone sues a school. I mean, would there potentially be any standing at all if a child is targeted?
Boy, there's a lot in that question, Gemma.
Yeah.
One of the things that I heard is what happens when there is an infraction and someone sues. And I think that's a really it's an elegant point, because the lawsuit currently in front of Judge Nye is on an injunction. This law has not taken place yet. And so the burden that the plaintiffs have to overcome to get an injunction is higher than if the law had actually gone into effect, someone had been allegedly injured, and then we challenge the validity of the law. So there's a difference between the burdens that a legal practitioner has to overcome when seeking an injunction versus when saying, hey, I've been injured as a trans person, I have been injured, and this is how, or the school saying, we had to pay this $5,000 and we think this law is unconstitutional. So that's kind of an interesting dichotomy that we have, because of the fact that this lawsuit is an injunction rather than a lawsuit that occurred after a harm happened. But to kind of get to the other question that you asked, is this targeting these students? Is this law targeting a particular group? And I think that if the court reaches that threshold question and answers yes, that this is a protected class, then the rest of the analysis is pretty easy, because that means that the court has to use a very high level of scrutiny. The burden shifts. Now, instead of the burden being on the plaintiff, the burden is on the defendants. They have a burden to show an exceedingly persuasive justification. In other words, that the Idaho legislature had an exceedingly persuasive justification in creating this law. And what was the justification? They say so in the actual statute. They say that the reason they created this law was for the safety and the privacy of Idaho school kids, which is something I think worthy of discussion in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, because we of course want all of our children to be safe in school and protected in school. The facts stand that we have had more school shootings that have impacted students than we have had of a kid using the wrong bathroom.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. Standing alone, in theory, in the abstract, the safety and privacy of our school children is, yes, it's a very important justification. But and I think maybe James can speak to this a little bit better, but during the debate on the legislative floor, there was no evidence that was brought up at any time that there actually was a danger to students who were using bathrooms that were inclusive. And you know, a lot of schools, James mentioned 25% of the schools here in Idaho have inclusive bathroom policies that have been going on since 2015, if not longer. And we don't have any history data that suggests that that has been harmful, that there have actually been these mm-hmm. sexual assaults that the statute identifies, at least in its text. So I think that the court, when looking at that that justification that the Idaho legislature identifies, the court's going to dig deeper and it's going to say, okay, well, what is the evidence that there was harm, that there is harm to Idaho school kids when we've had inclusive bathroom policies for 25% of the schools in Idaho for many, many, many years now.
Mm-hmm. And James, I only have about 2 minutes left, but can you speak on that point a bit more, as McKay brought up, because when these arguments were made on the state house floor, as this bill was being debated, there was not evidence of harm. Is that a correct statement?
I don't know if that's a correct statement. It wouldn't necessarily surprise me, just because, with a lot of these bills, specific evidence on the House floor isn't necessarily, raised or presented. Mm-hmm. If one was, I think I would turn back to something that I've seen a lot of the proponents of this law cite on social media, which was that Loudoun County, Virginia case a couple years ago, where an underage girl was sexually assaulted in a school bathroom with a guy, another underage student wearing a skirt, allegedly. A lot of conservative news outlets reported that, this was a transgender student who sexually mm-hmm. assaulted this girl. But, as the court case sort of wound its way through the system, found out that, that was not the case, that these two students had had previous sexual encounters in school bathrooms, though this one was non-consensual. That was certainly discovered. But that's basically the main case that people point to. But again, okay, it's unfounded.
So I only have about a minute left. So Jimmy, can you just quickly tell us exactly where we are now in this case as of yesterday's court appearances?
Yeah, the law is temporarily suspended with the temporary restraining order in place that was enforced last month. And Judge David Nye is going to consider these arguments that were held yesterday in whether or not to include a more longstanding preliminary injunction. And so, that could take days, but I've seen it take weeks and certainly months for those decisions to be made. So I don't know exactly when that might come down.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much for your expertise in regards to this case and taking time today to talk with us. We've been speaking with our very own Boise State Public Radio news reporter James Dawson and McKay Cunningham, the director of on-campus exponential learning at the College of Idaho. We've been discussing Idaho's public school bathroom law. Again, thank you both so much. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.